Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome. Welcome. This group was offered an opportunity last March to go up to the Wilson House in Dorset, Vermont, and present a workshop. And that's what we did. I was the one who kind of set it up and set up the itinerary and picked the people who were going to be presenters. And we're going to have all of those people are going to be doing the exact same thing for the next 12-week period. It was a very, very good seminar. I expect this will have its highlights also. One thing that I think everyone is going to have in common is the people that have been asked to present all are people who have experience working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been around the fellowship for a good period of time. And they have a lot of experience working with others, because basically this particular workshop is going to be specifically aimed at how best to transmit the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to your new prospect. In other words, let's say we've gone through the steps. We're going to bring a number of people up here who are going to be able to share their experience with transmitting the 12-step process to new people. And I think that there's certainly a need for that in AA today. I think that one of the things that I've found to be very, very true is at a lot of meetings, and a lot of sponsors do this, what they do really is they merely encourage you to not drink. I know that when I first came around, there was a lot of meetings that would do that, and there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, I think that that's a very, very fundamental and vital thing that the fellowship provides, is that encouragement. However, there's a lot more available in Alcoholics Anonymous. What is available through transmission of the experience that's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is freedom from alcohol, recovery from alcohol. And the difference between encouraging somebody not to drink and offering them a program that will lead to their freedom from alcohol and their recovery from alcoholism is like the difference between night and day. It's like the difference between black and white. It can sometimes be the difference between life and death for certain individuals. So hopefully we're going to bring some value over the course of the next few months to your ability to transmit the experience, to your skills as a sponsor. We hope that you'll pick up some stuff that works for you too. I'm going to read a couple of things here. One thing I need to say is that no one that gets up here at the microphone speaks directly for AA as a whole. Some of us may secretly believe that we speak for Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson in their grave, but the fact of the matter is we're just sharing our experience, we're sharing our understanding, and sometimes we're sharing our opinions, and hopefully we'll try to keep the opinions to a minimum. We're trying to bring our perspective and experience on recovery, on the recovery system found in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, to others as best we can. Again, we don't wish to indict anybody's program of recovery. You know, my first sponsor did not do what we're going to be going over here. You may not be doing it like we're going to go over here. Don't worry about that. We're merely trying to talk about our experience and the information that's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Personally, I've found that when I stay closer to what it asks me to do in this book, I have better success, and the people I work with have better success. Sometimes I try winging things, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but I believe that if we stick close to the book, we're not going to be far from off, I'll tell you that. I'm sure that there are many other methods that we won't discuss that have produced good results. You know, that's all well and fine. There's a lot of fellowship stuff that we're probably not going to be covering that's very valuable. But hopefully we'll be sticking to the book to the best of our ability here. I want to read three quotes from our conference-approved literature that I think kind of set the stage for this particular workshop. The first one is from the Step Book, and this is a quote from page 174. It says here, "Unless each AA member follows to the best of their ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, they almost certainly sign their own death warrant." That's a strong statement. The next one is from As Bill Sees It. This is page 105 from As Bill Sees It. "Our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program." That's our chief responsibility to the newcomer. So what we're trying to do with this workshop, again, is to bring some value to you in your ability to adequately present the program of recovery to the newcomer. It's very vital. I mean, some people can live or die on whether or not you're good at this. That's absolutely true. The next quote is from a pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcohol, that was penned by Bill Wilson. "Sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of an AA group." The teaching and practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of the AA group. You know, we may have bake sales, we may put on a hell of a dance, you know, every year, but our sole purpose as an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. You probably wouldn't know that going into some meetings that are around the North Jersey area. But then again, I don't judge. Bill knows that. Our first presenter in this series is Barefoot Bill. Just a brief introduction. I've known him for years now. This guy is for real. He works a hell of a program. He's constantly working with others. He has a life that truly is based on service. Anybody that's on his email tree understands the amount of work this guy does as far as carrying the message in AA. And I'll say this without without any exaggeration at all. He is at least in the top 10 historians of Alcoholics Anonymous in the early days of AA. He's at least in the top 10 in that area. He doesn't make any money at it. He does it for fun and for free. But he's one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet as far as what has gone on with AA in our past. And I don't know why I was guided to develop this, design this particular topic for him. But when I first, when it first came to me, I wanted him to do about an hour on unofficial AA history. That was what came to me, because our conference-approved literature is wonderful, but it paints a rosy picture. I mean, these guys were a lot more nuts than they paint themselves out to be, and they did a lot more crazier things. And there's some very, very interesting history that they don't necessarily talk about at the conventions. And if there's anybody that can dig that stuff out, it's Bill. But then Bill talked to me, and he goes, "Look, change the name because that makes it sound like it's bogus, you know, unofficial. How about obscure AA history?" So I said, "Sure, that's the same thing." So what I want to do is I want to bring up my friend Barefoot Bill, and he's going to do probably 45 minutes to an hour on obscure AA history to start this workshop off.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bill Lash. I am an alcoholic. You know, what I'd like to do is present from the bowl filled with ice in the back, if you don't mind. For those of you that were up at the Wilson House when we were up there, I think it was in March, it was a phenomenal event. What was interesting was, I know when I first heard the idea of what we were going to do, what went through my mind was it's going to seem scattered, because studies that I had experienced before were usually one or two people, and there seems to be kind of a cohesiveness in a one direction with just one or two people. But with, you know, perhaps 10 or 12, I had wondered if it would seem scattered. And I got to be honest with you, it was one of the most powerful studies I've ever seen, simply because it was a group of people with a lot of experience with this stuff, with this program, with this book, and with the application of the principles in this book, that it went off really well. So hopefully we can repeat that. I mean, even if it's repeated at a 50% level, it still will be very phenomenal. What was interesting, too, is the contrast between a male opinion of the same material and a female opinion. Maybe you'll notice that over the next few weeks, is that there is a very significant sort of experience with a male and female presenter, and hopefully you'll see that over the next few weeks. I first became interested in AA history. I have my own fan. That's great. I was in the fellowship for about 3.5 years, slowly dying from alcoholism, not drinking. There are other ways to experience an alcoholic death besides a physical one, and I was experiencing the other two. Mentally and spiritually, I was slowly dying for 3.5 years in AA, not drinking. And I reached a point where I was either going to take myself out or I was going to go back to drinking. And I started talking about what I was going through. And someone who was uniquely qualified to recognize what I was describing came in my path. And as I described to him the horror of my inner unmanageability, the more I talked about it, the more he laughed, which I didn't appreciate. To the point where I finally just stopped and said, you know, I'm sharing my guts here, and it's not very nice, and I'm not happy about it, and I'm not sure why you're laughing. And what he shared with me after that, since he was uniquely qualified to recognize what I was going through, he described to me exactly what I was going through, except he was experiencing it a year ago, and he was no longer there, as the result of getting involved in the program out of the big book, going through all of the work, every aspect of his life changed, and he stood before me a completely different person. And I had known him for 3.5 years, and I saw that a year ago something had happened to him. And I thank my higher power for that opportunity and for that happening in my life, because I don't know what other way I would have went in if this man hadn't had this conversation with me. I started getting involved in the big book, and as I got into the big book, I heard of these people, Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, Clarence Snyder, Lois, Fitzmayo, Hank Parkhurst. They were just cartoon characters as far as I was concerned. They were fictional characters that were written in some book. As far as I know, they didn't exist and it was made up. And then one year in June, the first Sunday, I think, of every June, up at Stepping Stones in Bedford Hills, New York, which is where Bill and Lois lived the last half of their life. I think it was from the late 40s until both of them died. They lived there. And we decided to go up for their annual picnic. And that was when my passion for AA history began, because up until that point, like I said, it was just fictional cartoon characters that I was reading about in some book. I had no way of knowing whether it was real or not. And now I was at this dude's house. And now I was seeing pictures of all these different people. And I was seeing their bed, and I was seeing their toilet, and I was seeing, you know, the first original big book, and I was seeing the dictionary that he used to use when he wrote the book, and I was seeing the table that Bill Wilson and Ebby sat at when Ebby transferred a lot of information to Bill, which actually changed his life soon after that. And it all started becoming real, and it all started becoming alive for me, and since then I've just had this unbelievable passion for AA history. And the one thing that I always like to pass along to people, if you were ever to get into AA history, is one thing and one thing only, and that is, as you look at our past, look for the hand of God through all of it. Because the more that I learn about these people, the more it's obvious that these people were not capable of doing what they did. And that if a series of coincidences and events didn't happen exactly the way they happened, we would not be sitting here today and there would be no AA. And I've seen that 30, 40, 50, 60 times in little stories and little tidbits of our early years in our history. And for me, that's a real beautiful thing, is to see God in and through all this. Because for me, this is very much an inspired program, and this is very much Each time two people get together and start talking heart to heart, for me, God is there. And we see it in our rooms, and we see it in our literature, and we see it in the transformed lives of, you can't get there from here. You know what I mean? Like, the person that I am today, I was not capable of being 10 years ago. It was just not possible. I am a completely different, transformed person. And just recently I started talking with my first wife, and I was still drinking during that period of time. And just recently I was talking to her about her marriage breaking up. And I was talking to her about, I've had three marriages break up. You really need to do all you can to make your marriage work. And, like, I'm counseling my first ex-wife. It is, like, the weirdest thing. And I was talking with one of my best friends in high school, and soon after high school, he was the best man at my first wedding. And, we were just talking about, he's in recovery now. He's been in recovery for longer than I have. And, it's just amazing to talk about what it was like, because we're talking about two completely different people, who we are today and what we used to be. And it's a really beautiful thing because of that X factor called God. What I'd like to do is, Chris asked me to do some history. I'm not going to sit here and I'm not going to tell you a story about how Bill and Bob met. I'm not going to sit here and tell you how the first meeting started. Some of that to me is kind of slow and boring. And I try to be uppity and I love humor. And what I've tried to draw out of our AA history is interesting stories, humorous stories, things you don't necessarily hear every day. Most of what I'm going to talk about, most of you probably have never heard before. But these are real stories from our AA history. And the one that I'd like to start with is one of my favorite stories. In the late 30s and the early 40s, word started getting around that this doctor in Akron had a cure for alcoholism. They really, word hadn't gotten, nobody really knew what it was. They just, word of mouth started spreading this. A couple of magazine articles went out. And, at the time there was only two meetings. One was in New York, one was in Akron. And what they started doing was putting drunks on trains and buses, giving them a one-way ticket to Akron, saying, go see this guy, Dr. Bob, and if it doesn't work out, don't come back here. We're giving you a one-way ticket. See ya. You know what I mean? We hear he can do something for it. We're tired of dealing with you. Go away. And a gentleman that happened to was Clarence Snyder. Clarence Snyder started AA Group Number 3, which was in Cleveland. And for the first few years of AA, pretty much from like 39 to like 42, 43, Clarence and his area had a higher recovery rate than Dr. Bob and Bill combined. As a matter of fact, I've seen statistics in 1941 that there were 450 people in Cleveland that were sober, and in Akron there was 250, and in New York there was 100. So Clarence was very influential and even at times considered himself to be sort of a co-founder, and he's one of my favorite early AA characters because this dude was on fire. And he wasn't always the most likable guy, but he was very influential in being able to get this word out. He got it into the newspaper. There was a series of articles in Cleveland, and it was just amazing the results that he was having by passing along the PURE program that was out of the Big Book and that was being utilized at the time in AA. And so Clarence's wife puts him on a train. He goes to Akron with a one-way ticket. He gets off the train. He goes to St. Thomas Hospital. He gets to Dr. Bob's office, and Dr. Bob's not there, and the door is locked, and it's closed, and Clarence just kind of paces back and forth in front of the door, waiting for Dr. Bob to show up. And as he's pacing back and forth in front of Dr. Bob's office, he notices on the door, it says, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, proctologist. And if you don't know that, a proctologist is a rectal surgeon. Dr. Bob was a butt doctor. And Clarence thinks, rectal surgeon, that's a cure I never considered. Now, that's one of the stories I know. A lot of these I have to kind of read because I wouldn't do it justice. Where did the slogan think, think, think come from? I always thought think, think, think was kind of odd because the Big Book says thinking is a big part of our problem if you're an alcoholic. So why does it say think, think, think? On a humorous side, I heard on a speaker tape one time, The gentleman said, as far as I can tell, think doesn't make much sense. My best thinking got me into AA, and besides, the big book says that if I'm an alcoholic, my mind is a big part of my problem, so obviously thinking for an alcoholic is not necessarily a good thing. The only explanation I can come up with is that the slogan might be saying that on any one topic, we're only allowed to think about it 3 times. Now, in real life, where that slogan came from is actually on a tape of Clarence Snyder's again. He explained that in the early days, the calculators, the IBM calculators, came with a little card in it. And it said, think. Think about what you're about to do, think about what you're doing, and think about what you've done. So think about before you do it, while you're doing it, and after you do it. And Clarence explained that some drunk back in the early 40s made up a bunch of cards and passed it around to everybody in the fellowship. So that's where that slogan came from. I was on a website one time, and they had a bunch of early AA history trivia questions. I was able to answer all of them except for this one. And it said, which one of our co-founders had a tattoo? And what's interesting about that is I thought about it and I said, well, given the personality of Dr. Bob, who was kind of stiff, and given the personality of Bill Wilson, who was kind of loose and loaded, let's call him, I surmised that it was Bill. And when I opened it up, it said that it was Dr. Bob. And I looked into it, and Dr. Bob had a big, huge 32-point compass on one of his arms and was surrounded by a big, huge dragon. And still to this day, I have never once seen a picture of Dr. Bob where he was wearing a short-sleeved shirt. He always wore long-sleeved shirts because during one of his drinking blackouts, he got these tattoos, and he was always kind of embarrassed about it. He used to show it to his kids and stuff, and they were kind of entertained, but he basically always wore long-sleeved shirts so nobody could ever see it. Speaking of Dr. Bob, I love this story about the last days of Dr. Bob. All that I've read about Dr. Bob was that he was one of the most incredible people. He was a really wonderful, service-oriented, down-to-earth kind of guy. He wasn't always the most approachable. He was sometimes just quiet. But when he spoke, he really carried a pretty heavy message. And when he spoke, everybody, you know, he was kind of like E.F. Hutton. When Bob spoke, people considered what he had to say pretty heavily. About Dr. Bob's last days. As Dr. Bob's period of sobriety increased, more and more patients came to see him. And it looked as though one part of his ambition, which was to own a convertible, might not be possible or might not be impossible after all. You see, Dr. Bob was a car enthusiast. But finally he made it when in 1950 he got a brand new yellow convertible. The AA Grapevine has a picture of him at age 71 speeding through the streets of Akron in it. The long, slim lines made even more rakish with the top down. No hat, his face in the sun, into the driveway he sped, pebbles flying, tires screeching, he'd swoosh to a stop. And just then, before he had put 150 miles on this gleaming yellow convertible, Dr. Bob's malignant disease took over for the worse, and he had to give up driving. So this guy always wanted to get a convertible, and just before he died, he was given that opportunity to have a yellow convertible, and he really enjoyed having that. And it says here he was able to put 150 miles on it before he had to give up dying, or he had to give up driving. He died a few months later. Bill Wilson explained why there was no imposing monument to this man who saved so many people from alcoholism. When his grave monument was once suggested a few years before he died, Dr. Bob said, "My wife Ann and I plan to be buried just like other folks, and so only a simple plaque in the alcoholic ward at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, where Dr. Bob did so much work, commemorates his work as a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous." And earlier this month, or rather last month in June, I was actually able to go to Founders Day for the first time ever, and I was at Dr. Bob's gravesite. And it's just a plain, you know, maybe it's about this wide, maybe about this tall, and him and his wife are there. And I think it was earlier this year his daughter died, Sue Smith Windows, and her burial site's there as well. And I got to tell you, it was pretty amazing and pretty powerful and profound to be there with thousands and thousands of people. I think there were 12,000 people that were there this year. And it was one of the most unbelievable experiences being in Akron for Founders Day and all the things and all the history and being at Dr. Bob's house. And it was a pretty mind-blowing experience for me. At St. Thomas Hospital, one of Dr. Bob's major helpers was Sister Ignatia. There's a real funny story about her. She used to work in the alcoholic ward, and she was having a bad day and had to deal with alcoholics, some of which were drunk, pretty much the whole day, and she just wasn't having a good day. And she was passing by this half-drunk guy's bed, and the guy kind of grabbed her dress and kind of grabbed her to a halt and said, "Sister, please pray for me." And she kind of turned around and with a bad attitude said, "Listen, pray to God for yourself. He loves hearing from strangers." This is the first 13th step. Things like this intrigue me. I don't know why. There was a man we'll call Victor, a former mayor of Akron, and a lady we shall call Lil, who was the first woman to seek help in AA. So this is the first woman. This was AA's first experience with a female alcoholic. Together, Victor and the lady known as Lil started out to write the 13th step long before the first 12 steps were ever thought of, because at this time this is still the Oxford group. What is more, they say it began at Dr. Bob's office on his examination table while he was at the city club engaged in his Monday night bridge card game. In any case, Victor decided it was time for him to go home, but Lil was loaded. So he called Ernie to explain his predicament. When Ernie arrived, he saw Lil grab a handful of little pills from Dr. Bob's cabinet. We started going around the examination table, and she was trying to get the pills in her mouth, Ernie recalled. Then she made a dive for the window. I caught her halfway out. She was strong as a horse and used some profanity I have never heard before or since. I got her quiet, and Doc came in, Dr. Bob. We took her out to Ardmore Avenue, which is Dr. Bob's house, and put her in a room in the basement. They wouldn't even put her in the regular room upstairs. They put her in the basement, kind of locked her in. She stayed there for 2 or 3 days, and then her people took her home. Of course, they were never too kind about it and thought we didn't handle her right, but we felt we had done all that we could for her when she wasn't helping herself any. They say Dr. Bob was leery of anything to do with women alcoholics from that time forward for a few years, although he still tried to help as best he could with anyone who came along. And Bill Wilson, speaking with Sue Windows, who was Dr. Bob's daughter in the 1950s, recalled how they all were scandalized by this episode. Because although they were trying to help drunks, they were trying to become sort of a respectable kind of establishment, and they didn't really like bad press like these kind of stories. Bill said, "As drunks, I don't know why we should have been so scandalized by this episode, but we felt that the performance of some of these early people coming in would disrupt us entirely. Lil, I guess, was absolutely the first woman we had ever dealt with." Now, I'm only going to be presenting about AA history, but I wanted to throw out this one thing that I found. This is actually for me, it sort of paints a different picture of the 13th step. Because I found in the early 1950s a Narcotics Anonymous set of 13 steps that NA used to use. And as I read this, you'll see very much the AA program is in there, but they also include a 13th step. And this was the list. Like I said, it's not 12 steps, but 13 steps. And notice what the 13th step says. It says, 1, admitted the use of narcotics made life seem more tolerable, but the drug had become an undesirable power over my life. 2, came to realize that to face life without drugs, I must develop an inner strength. 3, made a decision to face the suffering of withdrawal. 4, learned to accept my fears without drugs. 5, find someone who has progressed this far and is able to assist me. 6, admit to them the nature and depth of my addiction. 7, realize the seriousness of my shortcomings as I know them and accept responsibility for facing them. And listen to this one, this one's kind of harsh. 8, admit before a group of NA members these same shortcomings and explain how I'm going to try to overcome them. 9, list from my own understanding all the persons I had hurt. 10, take a daily inventory of my actions and admit to myself those which are contrary to good conscience. 11, realize that to maintain freedom from drugs, I must share with others the experience from which I have benefited. 12, determine a purpose in my life and try with all the physical and spiritual power within me to move towards its fulfillment. And here's the 13th step. God help me. So now when somebody throws out something about a 13th step, tell them what the real 13th step was. On a personal note, as most of you know, my nickname is Barefoot Bill because I usually don't wear anything on my feet. While reading about Bill Wilson's childhood, I came across the fact that when Bill was growing up, his next-door neighbor's name was Barefoot Rose. So I guess I have a distant relative that I wasn't aware of. There's a new book that just came out over the last couple weeks. It's called Silkworth, The Little Doctor That Loved Drunks. It's about Dr. Silkworth. It has a whole bunch of letters that he wrote, a couple talks that he gave, as well as his early years and growing up and when he became a doctor and what it was like experiencing early AA and stuff like that. I highly recommend it. But there was a story that I got out of there because, of course, a new book came out, so I had to have it the first day that it came out. And I had heard about this story, but now this is actually directly from the book. William Duncan Silkworth, who wrote the two letters in the doctor's opinion, in his high school junior year, had a bitter disagreement with his music teacher, Mr. Adris. Reportedly, it was intense enough to cause a short suspension. Silky had a wonderful voice and enjoyed singing, but was very uncomfortable about singing solos. His teacher preferred solos. Most of the young boys resisted singing solos, and young William was no different. As was standard at many high schools in 1891, his teacher believed in strict discipline with the young men and enforced it by hitting or rapping their knuckles. And I know in my high school I was being hit too, so I guess, but this was back in 1891. It says, as the story goes, young Willie refused to sing a solo. The teacher rapped his knuckles in front of his classmates, and in the heat of the moment, Silky, a small boy, knocked his teacher down. To his father, it was the day he became a man. This is what the official school transcript stated. Had a music teacher who did two things wrong. One, rapped knuckles. Two, liked solos. Will was asked to sing a solo, knocked teacher down, went home, never came back. So although he became a doctor, he did go back to school, but this school he never returned to after that incident. All right, Bill Wilson in law school. On page 2 of Bill's story in the big book, it says, I took a light law course. I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. By the time I had completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. Now, this gentleman, Dan D., who was a lawyer himself, was curious about Bill's almost law career and contacted Brooklyn Law School for more information. That's where Bill went to law school, Brooklyn Law School. And this is what he wrote. I spoke on the telephone yesterday with Dean Traeger of the Brooklyn Law School, who had before him the school file on Bill Wilson's academic career as a law student in the early 1920s. He stated that in Bill's first year at law, his grades varied sharply from brilliant, he had a 90 in contracts and an 89 in torts, to mediocre, he had a 77 in agency and in partnerships. In his second year, his grades were even more up and down, including some high marks and also a 67 and a 68, which were flunking grades. Both of these failed courses Bill took again and passed. So Bill's, you know, half drunk, he's taking classes, he's failing them, and then he's going back and he's passing them. In February of 1923, Bill flunked a course in equity and left the law school. His file shows that he returned in September of 1923, when all his courses were third-year courses except for equity, which he repeated and passed. He was scheduled to graduate in June 1924, except that he failed a course called Executors and Administrators relating to wills, estates, and trusts. He again returned in the fall and began repeating that class, but left the law school finally in November 1924 without, according to the dean's records, again taking the exam on executors and administrators. According to Dan, he surmised that in later years, Bill remembered that he had more than once made up for and successfully passed a test previously failed, but that he did not recall that he had gotten around to retaking that last examination. So he went through all of law school and didn't take or pass the last test and then left law school. And if that's not alcoholic behavior, I don't know what is. Now, in the big book, three times it mentions Winchester Cathedral. Once or twice it even mentions that something pretty seriously happened to him at Winchester Cathedral, but never in the big book or in our AA history does it really mention what happened. I'm not sure if it's Passing On or AA Comes of Age, it does mention that Bill was filled with awe about being at Winchester Cathedral and seeing this beautiful old building, but it doesn't say anything more than that. Now, I've actually come across some early drafts of Bill's story, and this is what Bill wrote about his experience in Winchester Cathedral. It says, here I stood on the edge of the abyss into which thousands were falling that very day. When Bill was at Winchester Cathedral, he was about to go to war in Europe. Within a few days, he was going to be in the midst of real battle, possibly being killed, surrounded by death. So that was why Bill was experiencing what he was experiencing there, you know, just thinking about being at the edge of the abyss where lots of, you know, he'd be around lots of people who were going to be dying. A feeling of despair settled down on me. Where was God? Why did he not come? And suddenly in that moment of darkness, he was there. I felt an all-enveloping, comforting, powerful presence. Tears stood in my eyes, and as I looked about, I saw in the faces of others nearby, they too had glimpsed that great reality. So he had a spiritual, profound spiritual experience in Winchester Cathedral, started to cry, and when he looked around, he saw that the other men right next to him were experiencing the same thing that he was. And then in Bill's story, he talks about, you know, I wandered outside, and I saw the doggerel on a tombstone, and it mentions a tombstone, and that's actually what happened to him. He was kind of overtaken with this spiritual experience and kind of just wandered outside and notices this tombstone as the story goes along. This story I love about Bill because it really shows the depths of his alcoholism, and I can totally relate to what I'm about to share. It seems that Bill was struggling with alcoholism. He's going out with Lois and now married to Lois, and his alcoholism is continuing. And Bill is able to use his willpower to overcome many things, but for some reason he can't use it to overcome his alcoholism. What ends up happening is he can think of no more sacred place than Lois's Bible to write promises, and he also put the dates saying, Lois, I swear to you, this time I really mean it, and I'm not going to drink again. And these are the promises that he wrote in the Lois's dictionary, and it even gives the dates of when he wrote them, and it even tells you the verbiage that he used and the power that he had behind it. And I remember it so many times, swearing to wives and parents and friends that this time I really mean it, and I'm never going to drink again. And sometimes I was drinking later that day, and I really meant it when I swore that, but I could never understand why was I going back to it again. It says, on October 20th, 1928, Bill wrote in the family Bible, the most sacred place he knew, to my beloved wife that has endured so much, let this stand as evidence of my pledge to you that I have finished with drink forever. Now that was October 20th. Thanksgiving Day that year, which was a month later, he wrote again, my strength is renewed 1,000-fold in my love for you. Now that was November 28th. In January of 29, he added, to tell you once more that I am finished with it, I love you. So he did it three times in just a few months' period of time. None of these promises, however, carried the anguish Bill expressed in an undated letter to Lois, his wife. And he said the following, I have failed again this day. That I should continue to even try to do right in the grand manner is perhaps a great foolishness. Righteousness simply does not seem to be in me. Nobody wishes it more than I, yet no one flouts it more often. Again, he wrote a promise to his wife in the family Bible. Finally and for a lifetime, thank God for your love. The promise was dated September 3rd, 1930. Like those that had preceded it, it was not kept. That was the end of the Bible promises. And again, the power and the conviction that he wrote there, and I can so relate to that because I always meant it when I promised that. There were times that I didn't mean it, but there were times that I very deeply swore that I would never drink again. And I think those little captures in Lois's Bible shows the commitment that Bill had in the same way. I had mentioned earlier Cleveland and the recovery rate that they had. In Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it talks about a 93% recovery rate in Ohio, which is interesting. And actually what's interesting is being a person that's into AA history, I don't necessarily take statements like that for granted. I've done a lot of research about the recovery rates of early AA. As a matter of fact, I've put together probably a two-page, I don't know if you want to call it a report, but it's a two-page compilation of every single piece of recovery rate that I've ever found in the 1940s. And some of it includes specific people, specifically how they're doing, specifically whether they relapsed, specifically how much time they had. They did keep, bless you, they did keep specific recovery rates person by person. If you didn't show up at meetings for a few weeks, the secretary would call you, see if things were okay. It wasn't a random thing where people just throwing out numbers. Again, I've seen in Philadelphia, Ohio, they kept, when the Jack Alexander article came out, they had very specific person-by-person details of how people were doing in different towns that Jack Alexander went to. I've never seen anything below 50% recovery rate. It's pretty amazing. But like I said, in Cleveland, they had a 93% recovery rate and have the documentation to prove it. The thing was that back then, they took recovery very seriously. And if you perhaps came in the rooms and started womanizing, or kind of was a disruption at meetings and you weren't there because you seriously wanted to take action to overcome your alcoholism, there have been reports that some people were put into cars, driven 25 miles out of town, dropped off, and we were told, listen, when you're serious about recovering from alcoholism, we'll be happy to welcome you back to AA, but please don't return if you don't. I mean, they were just that serious that they would take people out of town 25 miles and then leave you and make you walk back to town. But again, the recovery rate and the passion and the seriousness that they had about this was a life or death situation for them, and they did not take it lightly. And if you were distracting, and if you were, you know, perhaps preventing other people from having recovery in their life, it was taken very seriously, and there were actions that they took. And you know, thank God today for certain traditions, because although there were times I've wanted to do that, I'm happy that you know, you don't hear about stuff like that anymore. Also, I'm going to skip this one. I thought this story was kind of funny. There was a man named Bob who was brought to the program just as he was about to do himself in. So he was about to commit suicide, and they pretty much got him and they brought him into AA. A few days later, Bob went on a 12-step call with this gentleman named Walter. The prospect, the guy they went to 12-step, they went to visit, listened to them, and said, "What you have to say is very interesting, but I don't think it's for me. However, I have a friend whose brother could really use your help." "Who is he?" said Bob. "I don't know his name, but his sister's is Edith M." Bob says, "Edith M is my sister." And Bob just realized that he was being advised to make a 12-step call on himself. To give you some idea of the dangers involved with working with women in the early days, Oscar W. recalled the first man killed on a 12-step call. "He called on her after her husband had left for work." I guess there's his first mistake, said Oscar. "The neighbors saw this and told her husband." And, you know, back in those days, you know, men didn't come to visit a married woman, really, unless it's their brother or something. "One night, the husband lay in the weeds outside the house waiting for the guy, and when the AA came along to take the woman to a meeting, the husband shot him with a shotgun. This was in upstate New York, and it is said that soon after this incident, they named the clubhouse after this gentleman." So I guess they made up for the situation. As probably most of you know, Roland Hazard carried the message of the Oxer Group to Abby Thatcher. Abby Thatcher carried the message to Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson carried the message to Dr. Bob. What's interesting about those scenarios is that Abby didn't ask for help. Roland showed up in court and started helping him. Bill Wilson didn't ask for help. Abby showed up and started helping him. Dr. Bob didn't ask for help. Bill showed up and started helping him. AA number 3, Bill Dotson, didn't ask for help. Bill and Bob showed up and started helping him. For me, that carries a powerful message in 12-step work. We don't help these people because they're sick. We help these people because we're sick and we need to be helping people. Now, a funny story about Abby and Bill Wilson. I've started hearing that although Bill refers to Ebi in some of the literature that I've seen about Ebi as someone that Bill used to drink with. Historically, they've only been able to find one documented piece of proof of that. And this is that story. This is a classic story. Bill was on business in Albany, New York. Bill and Ebi are drinking at the time. Ebi's family is from Albany. Now, Ebi's brother, older brother, Ebi's uncle, and Ebi's grandfather at one time were mayor of Albany. And at this time, Ebi's brother is mayor of Albany. Now, Ebi starts to get into trouble in Albany, and basically the family tells him, listen, you know, you need to get out of town. You're embarrassing the family. But before they did that, Bill Wilson shows up and starts drinking with Ebi for a few nights. And this is the story. There was a time when Ebi and Bill chartered an airplane, or in a big book it says, there was a time when we chartered an airplane to complete a jag. This is the full story. In early 1929, Bill remembered stopping to see Ebi in Albany, New York, and he had made the acquaintance, and Ebi had made some acquaintances with some airplane pilots. We had had an all-night party and then chartered a plane and a pilot named Ted Burke to fly from Albany to Manchester, Vermont. They were working on a landing field in Manchester, but no planes had landed there yet, so we called Manchester to tell the folks that we were going to be the first arrivals. Now, back in those days, a plane landing in an airport was like a major event. Like, you know, the local band shows up, all the politicians, the whole town turns out. You know, they bring the farm animals. It says, drunk as he was, the pilot was pretty reluctant, but finally off they went. Bill vaguely remembers spotting the town of Bennington through the haze because it was really cloudy. It was not only are they wasted, but it's like really cloudy and really bad weather. The excited citizens of Manchester had got a welcoming committee, including the town band and the town's representatives. They circled the field. But meantime, all three of us had been drinking pretty heavily. And notice what he says. Somehow we landed on a pretty bumpy meadow. The town charged forward to welcome us. It was up to Ebi and me to do something, but we could do absolutely nothing. We somehow slid out of the cockpit, fell onto the ground, and there we lay immobile. Such was the history-making episode of the first airplane ever to land at Manchester, Vermont. Also, when Ebi was asked to leave Albany to go to Manchester, you know, just go to the summer town, you know, take care of it, get yourself together. Ebi shows up at the town, he starts causing problems, he gets arrested a few times, and at one time, the family stopped sending Ebi money because Ebi was getting into too many problems and he was drinking too much. And at one point, Ebi sold all of the furniture in the house so he'd have money to drink. And again, I mean, I can totally relate to that. I mean, I get to see Ebi like having a garage sale with all the furniture, you know, this really beautiful furniture because they were a really rich family. Tradition 3 states the following. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Here are two examples of why this tradition came about. This is a letter dated December 5th, 1941, and it's from the Executive Committee of the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dear Mrs. Irma L., at a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous held December 4th, 1941, it was decided that your attendance at group meetings was no longer desired until certain explanations and plans for the future were made to the satisfaction of this committee. This action has been taken for reasons which should be most apparent to yourself. It was decided that, should you desire, you may appear before the members of the committee and state your attitude. This opportunity may be afforded you between now and December 15th, 1941. So they were giving her 10 days to explain whatever had happened, and I'm not sure what it was. What's interesting is that I sent out this to a group of people. Chris had mentioned my email address, and I guess this woman actually got forwarded this letter. And this woman is Irma's daughter, and she's going to be sending me the original letter with the original story of what actually happened. So stay tuned, and next time I tell this story, I'll actually have the story about why she was thrown out of the club. You may communicate with us at the above address by that date in case you do not wish to appear We shall consider the matter closed, and your membership is terminated. Now, this is another letter. It's dated December 11th, 1946, and this one's a classic. To Mr. Burton R. Now, this gentleman was a member of AA in Colorado, but I guess this is actually, this guy lived in Colorado Springs, but this incident took place in Denver, so I guess this is a letter from a Denver member to somebody in Colorado Springs about what had happened. It says, "My dear friend, this is to advise you that one Bob W., who claimed to be a very good AA member, has asked to appear before the Denver Group 1 Committee to defend charges unbecoming an AA member." I cannot imagine what that was. Or I probably can imagine, actually. The committee found him guilty. All seven members voted for expulsion. He claimed unfairness of the committee and asked to be heard before the entire group. So there was a committee, and now he's like, "Well, that group voted against me. Now I want to go in front of the whole group, everybody." Request granted. The final vote was 31 for expulsion and 2 against. Since we no longer have him with us, this is classic, since we no longer have him with us, we look forward to less friction and more harmony in our club. Mr. K has advised me of a request by Mr. W. to join him in a few social drinks. We are very sorry that occurred and assure you that all of us regret it very much. Trusting to have the pleasure of having you with us in the very near future, I wish to remain sincerely yours." So that's some examples about why Tradition 3 came about. You know, they were throwing people out and there were rules and regulations, and thank God that's changed. Hank Parkhurst was AA number 2 in New York. When Bill went back to New York, this is the first guy that he sobered up. Hank Parkhurst, let me call him Hank P. Hank P. lived in New Jersey. He lived in, I can't remember now. He lived in New Jersey, and this guy was a super promoter. Bill was a promoter, but Hank was a super promoter. And if it wasn't for Hank, I can honestly say I really don't think that the Big Book would have ever gotten out in the street. This guy was a wheeler and a dealer, and it was directly because of him that the Big Book actually finally got out to the fellowship. And here's a little story about Hank. Hank wrote a memo to Bill Wilson in late 1939, which asked questions that echo still today. Questions about the separation of money-making business and work for the love of it, about individualism and the cult of personality that was already beginning to gather around Bill and Dr. Bob. Hank asked, now notice this is classic. This is what he wrote in the letter. This is a letter Hank wrote to Bill. "Did Jesus Christ have an office? Why would money that would be better well spent, would money that was spent on an office be better spent for traveling expenses for people spreading the good news? Will there be a grand poovah of AA?" Some think that Hank wanted to be the grand poobah of AA, and it was evidenced by making himself president of Works Publishing on the stock certificate instead of Bill Wilson. They had stock certificates they were selling to try to get the money for getting the Big Book out. And kind of rashly, Hank Parkhurst put himself down as president, and everybody always wondered why, and he just said, you know, it's too late to deal with details, and he kind of just blew it off. It says, perhaps he was jealous with the attention that Bill was getting as a founder of AA. He wasn't the first, and he was not to be the last. Bill wrote him a courteous but reserved response. It implies that Hank was drinking at the time. And this is what Bill wrote back to Hank. Another point, the gang would like you to come back with us very much. It would be helpful to you, to them, and most helpful to me. Even with respect to the book, it is difficult to sell your suggestions and ideas to people who sometimes feel that you are no longer one of them. At any rate, Hank finally broke down completely and went on a terrific bender after 4 years of sobriety, and he never again showed real signs of recovery. So it's kind of interesting because that gentleman stayed sober for a few years, was very instrumental in getting the fellowship started and getting the Big Book out, and then basically went back to drinking and never really got sober. This is in the Big Book, but not a lot of people read. I guess We have, over the last few years, read Dr. Bob's story here, but I always thought this story was kind of funny, so I want to repeat it. In Dr. Bob's story, he talks about the famous beer experiment. Now, this is during Prohibition, and just before Prohibition ended, they allowed people to drink beer because they just felt it's not that big of a deal. Let's let people drink beer. And this is Dr. Bob's beer experiment. And this is what Dr. Bob wrote in his story in the big book. For the benefit of those experientially inclined, I should mention the so-called beer experiment. When beer first came back, I thought that I was safe. I could drink all I wanted of that. It was harmless. Nobody ever got drunk on beer. So I filled the cellar full with the permission of my good wife. It was not long before I was drinking at least a case and a half a day. I put on 30 pounds weight in about 2 months. I looked like a pig and was uncomfortable from shortness of breath. It then occurred to me that after one was all smelled up with beer, nobody could tell what I had been drinking, so I began to fortify my beer with straight alcohol. Of course, the result was very bad, and that ended the beer experiment. And for me, that's classic. You know, okay, I can drink beer. Let's fill up the basement. Another interesting fact about Dr. Bob was that, besides the fact that I'm sweating like a pig, Dr. Bob and his wife, Ann, were engaged for 18 years before they got married. I love that. I don't know why. I really love that. It's almost like, why bother? You know what I mean? 18 years they were married, or they were engaged before they got married. They were not sober when they got married, I believe. I'll get back to you on that. Two more stories. In the big book, Bill has this passing comment in Bill's story. It says, I can't remember what it says specifically, but it says something about it was to cut me to ribbons like a boomerang. And it's interesting that he mentions the boomerang because this story is a real story from Dr. Bob's life. And it's a pretty incredible one. And it's even more incredible when you realize that Dr. Bob was 12 years old when this happens. It seems that by this point, Bill's father basically abandoned the family. And then Bill's mom decided, I need to go to schooling. And basically leaves Bill and his sister with her parents, the Griffiths. And she leaves. So now Bill's living up at the Wilson House, which is now the Wilson House, up in East Dorset, Vermont. And, you know, the grandparents are basically being Bill's parents. Bill's grandfather, Fayette Griffith, said to Bill one day, I've been reading a good deal about Australia lately, and no one seems to know why, but Australians are the only people in the world who have ever been able to make a boomerang. There was a pause, and Bill looked at him and said, the only people are Australians? No one else outside of Australia has ever made a boomerang? So young Bill set to work reading library books, speaking with woodcutters, covering every available scrap of paper with diagrams, and finally sawing, carving, whittling, throwing every type of wood he could find. He started this in the summer, and 6 months later, when it was midwinter, Bill in silence led his grandfather to the church graveyard. His grandfather, Fayette, would always remember this day because that morning his wife, Ella, had discovered that a 3-foot plank had been cut from the headboard of Bill's bed. And it had taken some doing to calm her down. They stopped by a tombstone at the edge of the churchyard. Bill took his stance, legs spread, the weapon in his hand. He stretched out his arm, spun his body round, and the boomerang flew out, curving farther and farther over the graves. By this time, it kept on. Instead of spending itself, though he was expecting it to die, he was just really just seeing if it would work. Instead of spending itself, it seemed even to be taking on momentum as it kept going in a perfect circle until There was no question about it. It was definitely returning, coming back right toward them with a long, low whistle sound of a giant beetle shooting through the air. It was circling back nearer and nearer straight toward them. Suddenly, Bill yelled out a yell, and they threw themselves forward flat on the ground as the boomerang dipped and cracked against a tombstone right next to them. For a full minute, they lay side by side on the frozen earth, panting, hardly able to take in the magnitude of what they had just witnessed. If they had not ducked, if they had remained standing, they would have been decapitated. They very slowly both sat up, turned and looked at one another. Still, neither of them even smiled. "I did it," Bill whispered. "I did it." Then with a wild leap, he was on his feet and a banshee cry that could be heard 7 miles away in Manchester. "I did it." Bill's grandfather later told everyone he could find that Bill was the first American to do it. R. Willie, the number one man. So Bill, at age 12, did something nobody else in the world outside of Australia had ever been able to do. Pretty amazing story. Now, this story I just recently came upon, and I really love it. First of all, I love it in its humor. I love it in its ignorance of what AA was all about in the early days. Nobody really knew. And I love it because the closing part of this contains one of the most powerful pieces I've ever found written about AA. I really love this ending. But here's the story. This is called The Springfield Seven. This is an AA moment to remember, and it was a police raid on the Springfield, Missouri AA clubhouse on August 24th, 1948. Here are some of the sordid details of this dastardly deed. The Springfield Police Department got an anonymous tip about commercialized vice, quote-unquote, at the AA club. And what's interesting was back then, they called it an AA club, but very often they would just call it a athletic association. Yeah, that's what it stands for. You know, because they didn't want people to know it was about alcoholism and all that. So they'd say, this is an AA club. And if somebody asked, they'd say, yeah, it's athletic association. That's what AA stands for. So police staged an early morning raid, complete with 7 officers and 4 police patrol cars. The next day's newspaper headline stated how 6 policemen boldly captured 7 ex-anonymous poker players. And of course, there were ex-anonymous AAs after the police got through with them, and now it's in the newspaper. They netted approximately $28 in cash and chips from a 10-set limit poker game. The game was played with chips, and the only money on the table was several dollars in change that had just been given to players who had just purchased chips. The remainder of the money was in a basket beside the playing table. One AA gave this eyewitness account of the raid. 3 officers entered the room first. One of them shouted, "Don't touch the money. Don't touch anything." The AAs froze. "Playing poker," one officer explained. "That," said one player, "is obvious." "A big game. Look at all those chips," said the policeman. One of the AAs tried to explain that it was a 10-cent chip, that they were using 10-cent chips, but the officers weren't listening. Then 3 additional officers charged into the room, and the 6 policemen escorted the 7 men out. 4 police cars waited outside the club. 1 or 2 AAs were put in each car and driven to the police station where they were booked. They were released only after posting a $350 cash bond. Later, they were tried and convicted on betting on games. The incident was described, this is what the newspaper said. The incident was described in the newspaper as ludicrous display of authority. It was in the newspaper for days. It was on the front page, the editorial page, the talk of the town page, and the letters to the editor page. And this was not just one newspaper, but all the newspapers around the town. One newspaper reporter provided this editorial comment. "Speaking frankly, we think that the AA raid was a horrible mistake on the part of the arresting officers. We think they did not even know what was going on in the first place. That when they arrived there, they did not know the meaning of AA. That when they walked into the game, they did not recognize the players or conclude from their surroundings or their dress that they were persons of importance. Therefore, they were not disposed to listen to the efforts of the players to explain." Another report was even more emphatic in his denunciation of the police action. I can't think of any pinch which causes less embarrassment to the pinchees and more embarrassment to the pinchers than this dazzling episode in the history of Springfield law enforcement. As a blunder, it was brilliantly conceived and beautifully executed. As a blunder, that's great. Sheer genius working in reverse with incredible skill. The full names, ages, addresses, and occupations of the AA criminals, quote-unquote, were published in the pages of the newspaper. The Springfield Seven were as follows. Ray D., it gives his address, and then it says, golf driving range operator. William L., and it gives his address, and both of these guys are 38 years old, member of an abstract company. Orion S., 43 years old, gives his address, restaurant operator. James H., 43, gives his address, or I'm sorry, 31, gives his address, salesman. Harold P., 37, gives his address, meat cutter. Harold B., 34, gives his address, septic tank cleaner. He's a septic tank cleaner. Charles C., gives his address, musician. What's interesting to me is that all seven of these guys had jobs, and were just hanging out at the clubhouse waiting for AAs to come in. Among others, James H., Ray, and Ann D., who wrote letters to the editor, this is what James had to say. James was one of the guys that got arrested. It says, since I am one of the notorious gamblers captured in the daring raid, and considering the widespread interest shown in this case, I have decided that my eyewitness account of the story may be of some interest to you. As I try to reconstruct the scene, I think I had just called a 10-cent bet made by one of the more reckless players. The whole thing, like, from now on, it's like just facetiousism, it's classic. By one of the more reckless players, when a voice about 2 feet behind me snarled, "Don't touch a thing," I rolled around to see a cop with a flashlight in hand aim directly at us. I think the flashlight was one of those 8-cell jobs. He held the seven of us at bay with this deadly weapon until two more officers moved into position and had us completely surrounded. Since paying my fine, I have given the matter considerable thought and I have drawn my own conclusions. The raid, although a masterpiece of police efficiency, was not only an utter waste of time, but outright stupid. And then Ray got arrested also, but Ray and his wife Ann wrote into the newspaper as follows. Speaking for ourselves and believing we express the sentiment of many of our Springfield members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we'd like to say thanks to personal friends of AA for a most kindly and good-natured understanding of our brief and unfortunate tangle with the city police. And I guess the AA started asking them questions, and these were the responses to the questions. Yes, we know where there is a poker game tonight. No, we are not going to file suit against the police to get back our poker chips. Yes, we think the whole thing is silly and stupid and utterly ridiculous, but no, we don't think any of the fellows or girls are so disruptive that they are likely to take to the bottle, and no, we don't think the reputation of the club has been damaged, and no, most emphatically no, we don't think that we personally have been embarrassed by the occurrence. And now notice this, for me this is a classic piece of AA literature. This is really beautiful, I love this. They continue to write. It says, you see, AA to us is the way we live, or rather, the way we try to live, since we are hardly likely to attain all of the goals of AA in one lifetime. AA is sobriety, but AA also is self-respect and respect for the understanding of others. AA is the restoration of old friendships and the formation of new ones. AA is the reconstruction of old ideals with a new hope for their eventual reality. AA is a purpose to be worked toward, with the assurance that there will be friendly and adequate help along the way. If you understand in some small measure what AA has meant to us, you will see that we would be extremely ungrateful if we did not welcome every opportunity to identify ourselves with this organization. To those who may need its help, to anyone who is interested in it from any standpoint whatsoever, and to the general public when the occasion indicates it. In the present case, our anonymity has been eliminated by the city police, but this is certainly a minor matter. You can see that the police raid provided the early Springfield AAs with the opportunity to demonstrate that love and tolerance of others is our code. And I love that ending piece to that story, because I truly do believe also that AA is not about not drinking. For me, AA is a way of life that doesn't need to include drinking. You know, it's a happy, contented, useful way of life that I feel good enough on the inside that I wouldn't drink alcohol to change that. And I think that little last piece there really touches upon that for them, this really was a way of life. And it was, you know, trying to move towards certain ideals that were so high that they kind of never felt that they'd be able to reach it, but they have to keep working toward it. And that, yeah, you know, maybe there was a little embarrassment there, and yeah, their anonymity was broken, but maybe they were able to see the good in it, and maybe if that could draw attention to AA as something that could help some people that maybe no other way would have been able to be helped unless they just read that article about AA, it was useful to them, because for them it was a way of life, and they'd be ungrateful for the people that were now going to come in because that article was written, even though it was kind of a negative article. So I just kind of wanted to close there because, first of all, I really love the story. It's rather funny and kind of humorous. But also, I love that whole ending part of AA being a way of life. And, you know, AA being certain great high ideals that the more we work toward those ideals, the less we're moving toward our next drink. And with that, I'd like to thank you for participating in my own recovery, for the opportunity to talk about history and AA in general, which I really do have a pretty incredible passion for. I don't know, do we have a nice way of closing, or is there anything after this? And we have a nice way of closing.